I have
current geek.
Hello and greetings and welcome to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival. Oh yes, are you excited? I am. It's a special monthly look at the greatest films of all time. From a nerdy, geeky perspective, I'm Scott Johnson, he's Tom Merritt, and this week we're talking about... Oh, hey, we have applause. There's a live audience, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Because people are so excited.
Yeah, that was great. I didn't expect that. The movie is The Third Man. The Third Man. Tom is the first man, I'm the second man. Tom, welcome. Hi.
This is what it's like to watch The Third Man.
Yeah, and you know what it's like? Dialogue's down here. DVD. And then all of a sudden, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's just no getting away from it.
I don't think you should go there.
It really is kind of obnoxious. I can only assume it's this like 1949, you know, mixing.
It was groundbreaking. Nobody had, this was not a thing until they made it a thing.
True. And also, okay. So before we get into the film and all that, and we'll do that in a second, I want to tell you how I heard that music first. And it's not the thing I talked about pre-show. It's something very different. I'd heard this exact music and the name of one of the characters before. And I had heard it through the name Harry Lime, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard them on an old-timey radio thing that I probably heard in the last couple of years even. Just like playing on one of these stations that I like. I have these little, like, you know, shoutcast streams I listen to. And it's
Back in the mid-20th century, movies were often turned into radio plays after they came out if they were a hit. So Casablanca, There was a radio version with Humphrey Bogart. There was a radio version of this with Joseph Cotten, too.
And I would have guessed that the radio version came first, but from best I can tell, it's the opposite. It's the
most
other way
of the
around.
Time, that's not the case. It was the equivalent of, I guess, the closest thing we have today is when they make a TV version of a movie, right? So MASH, the TV show made after MASH the movie, or 9 to 5, the TV show. They would make a radio play if the movie was a hit. It was a very common thing.
Yeah, and I remember hearing Orson Welles' voice as Harry Lime, which is bad fruit. Don't get a Harry Lime. Just want to put that out there. Yeah. Just a recommendation. But I remember hearing this radio play, and the play itself or the radio episodes all seemed to be like he was the hero of something. Like he was solving some crimes or fixing a deal.
There was the adaptation of the movie. Yeah. And then there was a spinoff called The Adventures of Harry Lime that was created as a prequel to the film, centering on Lime's adventures prior to the events of The Third Man. And Wells plays Lime. And they say he is somewhat less nefarious adventurer rather than the way he is in the movie, where he's kind of a sociopath.
That's totally it. Like, I knew I'd heard these things, and I knew that they seemed like he was a little more of a protagonist and not, you know, an anti-hero or whatever. And then the movie, having seen it in this order, the movie kind of threw me, because the whole time I'm going, oh, he'll be fine. He's a nice guy. I've heard his radio shows before. He just is kind of a squirrely dude, but he gets the job done kind of guy.
52 episodes between 1951 and 1952.
I've heard a handful of those, and I don't know. Really threw me off, but
and an example of a successful prequel.
Oh, that's true. You don't have that very often anymore, or I guess sometimes.
I guess the idea was that he wasn't so bad until the events of the movie, and that's when he got really.
Yeah, things got a little funky there.
Sidian says, "Beloved child murderer Harry Lime."
So all right. I don't even know where to start with this. I guess we'll start with the movie itself. Tom, give me some background.
I guess there was a TV spinoff too. We could start there. Michael Rennie played Harry Lime in 5 seasons of The Third Man from 1959 to 1965.
And that was called The Third Man on TV?
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, The Third Man. Michael Rennie. See, this is, it's all news to me. I didn't know any of this was even a thing. I had no idea. So that's a very successful film right there, right? There it is. Shut that bloody bazooka player up! So that's my not a very good John Cleese impression, but anyway, if you haven't heard the cheese sketch from Monty Python, do yourselves a favor and go listen
cheese
to
shop.
How similar those are.
Winsleydale. Right.
So this movie came out in 1949. It was released
in the UK. It came out September 1949. in the United States, it came out February 1950.
Oh, okay. So I didn't realize that. Now, a lot of the cast were true Brits and maybe a couple of real Germans, I think. But a lot of people
Paul
in there.
Paul Horbiger, the porter, seems to have been an actual German actor.
Yeah. I think it may have helped had he not been, or at least it'd have been a little more English fluent, because when he did try to do the English bits that weren't subtitled, I had a hard time hearing it, Tom. It was hard.
Really? That didn't bother me.
I don't know why. I don't know if it was the sound transfer on this thing or what the heck was going on.
It was just the idea of, it was just like, oh, it's a German guy trying to speak English. Got it.
Now, you know about, directed by Carol Reed. And before you get too excited and go, female director of a great classic film in 1949. Boy, that was really progressive and interesting. No, it's a dude named Carol, just so you know.
Those things did happen, but that not this guy.
No.
This guy is English. And he's probably most famous for The Third Man, but he also did Oliver, the 1968 movie, Trapeze, Fallen Idol. He did lots and lots of stuff starting from 1935 through 1972.
Now, do you know the secret copyright history of this movie? You probably do because you're a genius with that stuff.
Yes, I do. The Third Man, along with Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps, are often used as examples, although there's dozens of others. Where they fell out of copyright in the United States because of not being registered. There was a period of time where you had to register and renew your copyright in the United States. So in 1996, the Uruguay Round Agreements Act tried to harmonize U.S. copyright a little better with copyright elsewhere and restored The Third Man copyright, among many other movies and other works, to Studio Canal. So from 1991 until 1996, because Graham Greene was the author, and when he died, the copyright died because it wasn't renewed under anybody else. Right. It was in public domain. I remember you could go buy really cheap copies of The Third Man on VHS at the Best Buy because everybody started using it. And then it went back into copyright in 1996. And the Criterion Collection got it. And I think they're the ones who administer it. Although Lionsgate has issued a Blu-ray of it. And we watched it on Netflix. So obviously it got licensed out to Netflix this time.
Yeah, and I saw it. I used to see it in bins at Walmart on early DVDs. Sometimes in compilations with other black and white oldies. And I remember thinking, oh, that's a movie that gets around. Look how common this is. But I didn't realize it was because it had skipped its re-registration, that it was out of copyright. And so for a hot minute today, I almost streamed the movie while I watched it until I realized, oh, it got not reversed, but it got thrown back into copyright until 2045 is when that comes up again.
Yeah, 2061 in the UK, 2045 in the US.
So I did a good thing and did not stream the movie today. I almost did.
Good for you.
Yeah, I could have been.
You can rest trouble. Easy that you have not broken the law.
I did not break the law or any terms of service on Twitch, mainly. But
there are also two versions of this. So there was the British release in the UK earlier, but it was also a different cut. They cut 11 minutes of footage under David O. Selznick, one of the producers, tutelage for the American version, because he did not think American audiences would relate to the seedy tone of the original. So if you see the American version, you're going to hear Joseph Cotten doing a narration at the beginning, and you get 11 minutes fewer scenes. If you see the UK version, which is what Netflix had, you get Carol Reed doing the narration at the beginning. And, you know, if it's Joseph Cotten, he's as Holly Martin's telling you his story. But the Netflix version with the UK version with Carol Reed, that voiceover is just sort of telling you what it was like in Vienna and then introducing you to the character of Holly Martin's as sort of your way into the story.
You ever meet anybody named Holly that was a dude before? Has that ever happened to you?
Holly, I don't think so.
Never met a Holly or a Carol for that matter. I was just curious.
I've definitely met a Carol. I had a Carol in my family, like a cousin.
Yeah.
His name was Carol.
Just a side note. Because it kept throwing.
There's also Carol O'Connor.
Yeah. He's got two R's or two L's.
Archie Bunker.
However that goes. There's Carol. That's it. That's all I know.
Carol of the Bells. The man who wrote Carol of the Bells.
Notorious male songwriter, Carol of the Bells. He was
I want to say there's a baseball player. Was it Carol Clay?
Oh, I don't know.
What was his name?
But it's just, anyway, it's unusual. And to see two of those in the same movie was throwing me a little bit, but I got used to it and read that this was supposed to be James Stewart. But in the end, I was totally cool with what's his beak. Forgot his name already. Where is it?
Yeah, I feel like the Jimmy Stewart would have been too wholesome for this. You wanted Joseph Cotton to have a little edge, yeah, right? You wanted, yeah, Holly Martins to feel like he was like he would have been a friend of Harry Lime, because he himself maybe didn't have moral compromises, but he was fine if his friends did, right? He wasn't too goody two shoes, and Jimmy Stewart often played the innocent. He often played the guys like, well, geez, Harry, why would you do that? Yeah. Or sort of thing.
Yeah, so even when he's playing salty and trying to be drunk or whatever, it's hard to take James Stewart too seriously in those kinds of roles. And I thought that Joseph Cotton did a good job of being a little broken.
I imagine Jimmy Stewart would have done a bang-up job. He's an amazing actor. But yeah, Joseph Cotton's feel as a personality, I just feel like fits Holly Martins perfectly.
So the movie is super noir-ish. We've seen a couple of movies like this in our list before. It's also, what, our third Orson Welles joint? I mean, he's in it, but you know what I mean? Like, he's around. He's involved.
I mean, he was in Citizen Kane and The Godfather, right?
Yep. So we've got two of those guys. Wait, was he in The Godfather? What did he do in The Godfather?
Wait, no, that was Marlon Brando. What was Orson Welles? What was the other one?
Oh, there's a third one. It's going to bug. There's the third man. I can't think of it. Anyway, I know he was in another one. I swear we've done two with him, or at least three, but maybe not. But so I'm gonna make a shocking proclamation. I actually think this is.
Oh, he was in Star Wars Episode IV. Oh, right? No, no,
I don't think so. Oh, in the Vader suit for a while.
He was the 13th Angry Man.
Nailed it. No. We've got it. No, you've done it. You've done it. Orson Welles is his best acting. I think he's better in this than anything else I've seen him in. So there it is. I'm planting my flag. And he's not even there very long. But the whole scene in the Ferris wheel and the conversation between him and Holly is really good stuff. The best part of the movie. And I think the best acting Orson Welles ever did. What do you say to that? To that high claim?
I think his acting in Citizen Kane at times beats this. Mm. I think he benefits from having limited number of scenes.
Yes,
he does benefit. And those limited number of scenes are crazy powerful, right?
Right.
Apparently he ad-libbed the remark about the cuckoo clocks because they were shooting, and for timing, they needed to add another sentence to what Graham Greene had written. So Welles just said, oh yeah, I know these lines from an old Hungarian play about cuckoo clocks. Well, it turns out they don't make cuckoo clocks in Switzerland.
Really?
Cuckoo clocks are made in an area of Germany.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. In the German Black Forest.
German-speaking Swiss, but...
But he didn't try to take credit for the line himself. He said, as the man said, so it is from somewhere. Apparently the likeliest source is Whistler, the artist.
Wow.
In a lecture on art, he talked about the Swiss, and cuckoo clocks, being their biggest artistic achievement, even though again, the Swiss don't make cuckoo clocks.
No, they make good chocolate and,
yeah. And skis.
Skis, yep.
And banking laws.
Yeah. Yep. Girls, yep. They make the Swiss girl.
Cheese,
right, with the holes in it. Yep.
Yeah.
Swiss bank accounts, those are cool.
Did you say Swiss Miss already? I think you did.
I think I said the girls, but yes, that was the reference. And then Swiss.
Swiss Miss pudding bars.
Oh, the knives, the Swiss Army knives.
Swiss Army knives, yeah.
All right. Well, then look, they've got plenty of accomplishments. What are we worried about? They're fine.
Yeah. Well, it's just that he kind of tags them as like, hey, all this peace and democracy in Switzerland, and they make no art. And Switzerland's like, well, okay, but we don't make cuckoo clocks either.
Right. No, they do not. Anyway, I just thought his performance was really strong and stuck with me. And when I got over the idea that who he was from the radio stuff, and I was able to focus on what this was by itself, I really got into the groove of his character, but it took a really long time for him to show up. And if I had any complaint, it would be that they were trying to be all twisty about it. I feel like I knew in the first 5 minutes that he wasn't dead and that this was all a ruse. So it's not like they were fooling me. And so it was just like, okay, you guys, I get it. Just get to the point where he shows up again. You know, obviously it's him with the cat in there. I mean, duh, who else is that going to be? Plus, you know, Orson Welles' name is on the marquee and he's not, he's not.
And you haven't seen him yet. Like, yeah. Are they going to do flashbacks or is he alive?
Yeah. So that kind of stuff is, I mean, in 49, maybe that was super suspenseful for me. It was like, oh, yeah, I've seen this before.
Well, I have a feeling it probably was a little more suspenseful, but also I don't think that's the point of this movie.
Mm.
It isn't an M. Night Shyamalan movie where they go, aha, look, time was a long time. It's more about painting a picture of what post-war Vienna was like during the extended occupation.
Mm.
So you got these four zones, the Russians, the French you barely see, but the British and the Americans. And there's this black market because, you know, they're still rebuilding. There's some great shots of them still kind of, you know, digging out rubble, and supplies are short on the ground. You know, everybody's taking his cigarettes. Every time cigarettes are offered, everybody takes the whole pack because there's a shortage of cigarettes.
Sure.
So I think it's, this is considered one of the greatest movies of all time because of the atmosphere it creates. And a lot of that is attributed to the music. The Anton Karas theme launched Anton Karas to fame. He was just a guy that I think Carol Reed heard in a cafe and said, that's the sound I want for my movie, and brought him to London to create the soundtrack. It was also the cinematography.
Yeah, in fact,
some of the reviews dinged The Third Man because it has that angled photography that always kind of puts you off kilter. But the point is, you're in an off kilter world. Mm-hmm. You know, things are not straight ahead. Everything's a little askew in Vienna at this time. And it's trying to get you unsettled by that. And I think it works really well.
It worked.
Way.
Yeah. And also, I'll tell you where it worked was in the sewers. Sewers were freaking cool. And they had great use of light and dark and contrast in there.
And
sound. Yep. And they decided not to have a lot of music in there, which I think benefited the movie. It just kind of.
Yeah, it wouldn't have made sense for anyone to be down in the sewer playing a zither, huh?
Yeah, going. Near, 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 near. There it is again. When you're running around in that place and you have so many opportunities for cool, shadowy chase stuff going on. They really maximize that, and I thought that stuff looked really rad, like almost comic booky, just great, almost like a drawing. There's a scene where they find him for the first time. He's at the end of a tunnel in the sewer system, and he's just sort of back there against the wall. So it's just him in his suit and his hat, and the way the light comes on and hits him, you get this crazy tube of darkness, but with flickering light all against the cobblestones that it's built out of, and then him silhouetted against the now well-lit back of this tube, and it's a striking moment. Like, just made me go, whoa, that seems fancier than they should have been able to pull off in 49. So no wonder they won an award for that. They should have. Cinematography was amazing. I guess they called it black and white cinematography back then, right? Because they had color was coming in, and they had to give both.
Oh, really?
Of them
their there was a different.
I think so.
Category for black and white.
I just
color.
I had just read that they won for black and white, and that made me think. Oh, well, then there's a color one. And I may have jumped to conclusions on that. Let's see.
Yeah, no, it is listed as cinematography black and white, so that must have been the case.
Yeah, because you're talking early 50s, which meant, you know, films were starting to come in color, so they probably felt like they had to make the distinction. It would be like us today going, I don't know. Like, for the longest time, we made this distinction between animation and real life or live action.
Well, here you go. Here's the real scoop.
Okay.
In 1936, they added a category for best cinematography color special achievement.
Oh, wow.
So cinematography was going to black and white films, and they made a special category for color to highlight the people doing a good job with color, because color was this new novelty thing. You know, the serious filmmakers weren't using it, so they had to give it a special achievement award. And then 1939, they took away the special achievement and just divided it into color and black and white. And I guess that lasted how long?
Yeah, when did that change? Because eventually we just get rid of the distinction, right?
Yeah, it's just best cinematography, but it lasted quite a while.
Yeah,
it lasted until 1966 was the last year they gave separate awards for color and black and white.
Oh, interesting. Because I'll notice, like, today a black and white, purposefully made black and white film will come out, get a bunch of awards and nominations and praise, and oftentimes win in that category. But it's just cinematography now. And it's interesting. They don't need to make that distinction.
What was the black and white movie that won Best Picture? five or so years ago.
The something, it was the one, it was like a 1920 silent film, and the name is escaping me.
It is escaping me is the name?
Yeah, that's the one, is escaping me. Chat room, do you guys remember? It's not Metropolis. No. It's new. It's a new movie, came out in like 20. Yeah,
it was just like 5 years ago.
Yeah, 11 or 12 or 13 or something. And it was called...
As soon as someone in the chat room shouts it out correctly, we'll pass it along.
We'll give you credit. Yeah, I forgot.
We know you're shouting at your podcast player right now, but we can't hear you.
Yeah.
I apologize.
I wish you were I wish the people in the chat room were saying things that weren't
but
Metropolis.
But don't email us yet, because we'll hear it from the chat room.
Or Young Frankenstein. Those are not
it's not Young Frankenstein.
I can't remember it.
Am
anyway.
I going to have to look this up myself?
Oh, shoot. Oh, the artist.
The artist. Thank you, Sidian.
Jeez, we have to count on Sidian for all this? My gosh.
I know. Sidian does all the work.
It's insane. Anyway.
Give that person a break.
But that movie, yeah, not only won Best Picture, but got nominated, maybe even won for cinematography. I don't know. But like Spielberg's guy did for Schindler's List.
I think it was
black and white as hell. So, that's a weird
literally,
way.
Literally, yeah.
Weird way to describe that, but. Anyway, I'm always fascinated by that, because the technology, as it changes, you never know while it's changing at the time this changed, if that was truly just a trend or a fad, or if it would just, you know, color would become the prominent thing. And now we don't even think about it. Like, film is just film. And if it's black and white, that's more like the gimmick now, because you're going back to a form that doesn't really happen anymore. Mm-hmm. Like whatever movie you're making. Nebraska is a good example, a modern film made in black and white. That's set in a modern time. But anyway, I like that when that happens. It'd be like 3D. If 3D really took off and became the new way everybody watched movies, it would be like us having a pre-3D award system, and then we would start making allowances for best cinematography using 3D. And then eventually just everything would be 3D. I don't think that's going to happen, nor did it happen, but that kind of stuff fascinates me. Anyway,
the other thing that fascinates me about this movie is it was a big hit in the UK and the US, but in Austria, they were underwhelmed.
Whoa.
They were like, plot's not very logical. Does create a good atmosphere, but I think it's because they lived in Austria. Mm. They're like, yeah, that's what Austria looks like. We're all wandering around with zithers playing, and that's just what life's like here.
The other problem,
whereas in the UK and the US, we thought that was really exotic.
They had city scenes all the time in that thing that there was nobody there, though. I wonder how real that was. Maybe that was just the right time.
Well, I have a feeling that was fairly real. I mean, this is reconstruction. A lot of people had evacuated. A lot of people had been killed because of the war. And a lot of people stayed off the streets because of all of the policing that was done by the international police forces. So I have a feeling that you didn't have big crowds. I could be entirely wrong about that, but that my assumption was like, this is post-war Vienna. It's not yet teeming with the masses again.
Right. I've never been. So to me, the imagery is very fascinating and super cool looking. And I like sort of gothic streets with, lots of rain either falling or already fallen. I like puddles. I like reflections. I like the whole noir thing that's going on in this movie. I will say, though, it just seemed like a whole lot of talking before they got to the meat. And when they got to the meat, I went, all right, now we're talking. And it's not that I just needed some action. I just felt like it's a lot of 1949 style. Let's just discuss everything over and over. And then
it's funny. I know that I'm wrong when I say this, because my film classes said I'm wrong. You just said I'm wrong. The chase scene in the sewer bores me.
Oh, wow. Really?
It is universally acclaimed as the best part of The Third Man.
Yeah.
A story well told without dialogue, using shadow and light and sound and everything you're talking about. And I totally appreciate that. But I always find myself drifting when that's on.
Mm.
And I love the dialogue heavy stuff. I love the atmosphere and the banter between Cotton and Volley, as she was known. She just went by one name for a while back then. And sort of the multilingual nature, where some people are speaking some French and then people are speaking German and then people are speaking Russian. And it's just sort of like, this is what this film, I think, to me, its most important thing is capturing a moment in time that I think will get forgotten, right? There's there's Germany under the Nazis, and then there's Germany, and then there's Austria liberated and booming again. But there's that short period of time where people are like, well, we got liberated, but they still got MPs running around here because everything's kind of in chaos. There's no infrastructure, and we have to set up a new government still.
Yeah,
you forget that Europe was like that.
I guess I'm with you on all of that on paper. Like, my favorite thing about Tarantino movies isn't the punctuated violence or any of that. It's the dialogue. It's the crazy conversations. It's the back and forth between characters. And I think that's true with everything I love, whether it's something like Fargo or something in a comedy, even having a hard time coming up with another name, but any movie where it's dialogue heavy and just really great language is being bandered about and all that. I love that. That's great. I think it's something about the time. I think it's something about the delivery in 49 versus what you might get today or you might have gotten in the 70s or something like that. I think it's because they all sort of just did stage acting. And that's a lot of standing and moving to the right and going, yes, I believe so.
Is it, or is it just the accent is different? Like, what Joseph Cotten does is just the way, like, what if what Joseph Cotten does is just the way people talked back then?
Right. I mean, yeah.
And if you were watching this in 1950, you wouldn't blink. You'd be like, oh, yeah, it's very realistic.
Yeah, but either way.
Because I don't see anyone else criticizing it for that. So I wonder if it's just you're attributing to acting what is just normal because it's a different time period. Maybe.
You might be right. 12 Angry Men didn't do this to me. That's a great example, by the way, of dialogue that you're just riveted by. And I couldn't, you know, there's no action in that movie.
That's 7 years later, though.
It is 7 years later. And maybe
it's 100% U.S.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I mean, I'd be willing to admit it. Maybe I'm just seeing it through a weird lens or something. But it happens to me with older stuff. Maybe it's all back when these transatlantic accents were even in American films and you had these other accents. Yeah, I normally love that kind of thing. In a modern film, it's not a problem. In an old movie, maybe it's because I just assume everyone's just faking it so much, you know? Like, even though there's some legit European voices in this movie, there's still a little part of me that goes, yeah, you're probably just some guy in Hollywood and you're not really
but
Austrian.
But they're not.
I know, you're
I think
right.
It's because
right.
You know that did happen, right. And it absolutely did happen,
right.
That you start to get suspicious of everybody, whether it was a case of that or not. That would make sense to me.
I agree. I think that's exactly what I'm doing. And I don't think it's a necessarily good thing to paint.
You're like, that porter, he's probably a guy from Jersey. He's not really German.
Yeah, a part of it
but
is.
But it turns out... He's Paul Horbiger, born in Budapest, Austria-Hungary. He was born in Austria-Hungary, that
wow.
guy.
He was born he was in Austria. Old. He was very hungry when he was born, I guarantee it. Yeah. Oh, you mean Hungarian, I get it. Hey, check this out, too.
No, Austria-Hungary, like Austria and Hungary used to be one empire.
Oh, yeah, they were
all
the same.
In the 1800s.
Same,
he was born joint. In the 1800s when Austria-Hungary was still a thing.
So the only person alive in this movie today is the little kid. I looked him up. You know how I get with this.
Did they pay him off to accuse that? The one part of the plot that really doesn't work for me is when he starts going, Holly Martins, he murdered. That's the guy to murder. I'm like, who paid him off to do that?
Also, it just felt like there were no consequences to that. Like the whole town's calling, you know, starting to say it to him because the kid's saying it. Nothing really happens. He kind of has to run and get away.
That felt real to me though. Which is like the crowd would turn on him. He would run away and the police would say like, man, it's doubtful that he did it. We have so much to do rebuilding the city. Like you get that feeling from the police constantly, from Calloway particularly, of listen, we just want to keep things under control.
Sure.
And he's telling Martins that all the time, like stop looking into this. Like, of course we know the black market exists. We're trying to stop the worst abuses of it. Harry Lime is one of the worst abuses of it, but you're not going to make things better by stirring up a bunch of trouble elsewhere.
Yeah. I think
that just makes their job harder.
I think the kid must've been paid off or the kid was just told to do it and he got candy for it. I don't know.
I feel like Ceausescu. What was his name? Popescu.
I don't remember.
Probably Baron Kurtz or somebody.
Yeah, they paid the kid off. Like, all you need is a couple of licorice whips and a freaking penny candy, and you're good.
But he's still alive.
That guy's still around, looks great. He looks great in his old age, and everybody else involved in this film is dead. So good job carrying the torch for this otherwise ancient film. And you know, where everyone else has died, which is for some reason I obsess now, about with these things.
People in the chat room are like, why'd they kill the porter and who killed him? I felt like that was obvious. The porter said, come back tonight. I have something to tell you.
Yeah.
And so they killed him. So he wouldn't tell him the thing. And who killed him? I don't know. Kurtz, Popescu, maybe Harry Lime, but they all had reason to stop that guy from talking.
Well, and when he turned around and stared at whoever his killer was going to be, we don't know who that
was. Harry.
It was probably Harry, but we don't know. But it probably was. It doesn't matter.
You know it was that gang that wanted him out of the way.
Right.
That doesn't matter. What matters is finding out that Harry's alive.
How did they... Oh, so here's the question, though. How did they know that the porter was going to squeal? Because they weren't around for that, I don't think.
Because he was yelling it into the street. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
There was somebody on the street was like, hey, porter's yelling that he's got something to tell. Get on the phone. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, you're right.
He's gone.
I forgot about
that. And it's important to the plot because it stymies Holly Martins from finding out. This is a very uncontroversial mystery move, which is you have the source who says, okay, fine, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to risk everything and tell you. And then they get murdered before they can tell you. And that leaves you back at square one. Okay, now I have to find another source.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's absolutely what happened. I kind of forgot about that. He was being real loud about it. And
he was yelling it down in the street and then going, shh, don't tell let my wife hear. Like, well, the entire rest of the street just heard.
Yeah, so. I hope nobody knows your wife out
also,
here.
Also, he's listed in IMDb as Harry's Porter. I think that was the inspiration for J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, Harry's Porter. It was his original name. It was the one that couldn't be killed. She wanted him to be the opposite of the porter who could easily be killed. So he was the the boy who did not die, Harry's Porter. we haven't said her name yet, but I want to because I think she's the best thing in the movie. Alida Valli, I think is how you say her name.
Just goes by Valli, though.
Okay.
Remember?
Oh, yeah.
She's credited as Valli because she decided to have just one name.
Okay. Well, that's cool.
I did mention her once briefly.
I missed that.
But yeah. Let's talk about Anna Schmidt.
Yeah. She's great. I don't know what it was about her portrayal, but I liked it a lot. I liked it better than other stuff from the era. She wasn't hysterical, she wasn't the stereotype. She was strong. She was smart. She was a little bit damaged, but she was
a little world weary as a post-war survivor would be.
Yep.
Someone from Czechoslovakia who's like, I just escaped Nazi Germany and now I have to skip the Soviet Union. Like, I will do whatever I need to do.
Completely bought into her character and her motivations and her emotions. I thought she was the best cast person in here. So as much as I really, really liked watching Orson Welles do his thing and chew up scenery for his brief moments. She's the most consistent thing across the board. And I think just made everyone else look like they were a little second rate. She was really good. And I'd never even heard of her before. Like, I don't know any other movies or TV shows. And she worked for a long time, worked all the way up to 2002.
Wow. 2002. Huh?
Yeah. She was always busy, always something going on, movies, TV stuff, just staying busy. And, I don't know. Came away with a real impression with her performance. People who are watching me watch the movie, which is how I did that on the stream today, they can confirm, like, she really stood out to me. And I don't know what it was, but something about her, something just really authentic about her. So it's kind of the opposite of the thing I was saying before about some of the dialogue early in the film. Her stuff just felt as real as could real be. And I liked it. So that's the highest praise I can give.
The worst actor in the film is Martin Boddy, who's a Scotsman playing a Russian.
Wait. Is he the guy?
He's the Russian military policeman.
Right. It was kind of obvious. I knew there was something wrong with the way he sounded, but he wasn't.
Can I have her passport, comrade? It wasn't that bad, actually, but it was very stiff and character, very much a character.
Yeah, and you know who else went on to do all kinds of stuff is this Trevor Howard guy. So he was Major Calloway.
Oh, yeah, Major Calloway.
Yeah, he's...
He was a kind of a famous British actor, even before Third Man, I think.
Yeah, and tons of work. He died in 1988, but in his career, was famous for all sorts of stuff. If you do an image search for him, you go, oh, I've seen that. Lots of...
He was in No Country for Old Men?
Yeah, he sure was.
Wow.
That wasn't that. Oh, no, that can't be right. Because that was made after the 80s.
He was in a TV movie called No Country for Old Men in 1981. Okay.
Based on the novel? Might have been. Well, now I'm shocked because I didn't know that existed. Wow.
An exploration of Jonathan Swift's time in Dublin in 1739. Okay, I don't think it's the same No Country for Old Men.
No, although there may be the Cormac McCarthy book might make reference to that in a way I don't know. I've only ever seen the movie, but
I don't think so. I think this is just Jonathan Swift.
He works a lot, though. Look at that dude's resume. Just freaking miles and miles of content. He started in 1944 and worked all the way up until 1988. Pretty consistently, lots of TV shows. And if you look at his face, you're like, oh, I've seen that guy before. He was on The Love Boat, for heaven's sakes. That guy got around. The main actor, though, who plays Holly, I forgot his name. There it is, Joseph Cotten.
Oh, how could you forget Joseph Cotten?
I don't know. I don't know why I forgot that, but I did.
The national treasure.
It's true. He died in 94 at 88, lived a nice long life. He was in all sorts of stuff as well. Yeah, tons of stuff. Also,
he's kind of, to me, I'm getting my back up a little because I feel like he is unappreciated. Like he was in Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
We mentioned like, oh, it's our second Orson Welles movie. Yeah. Also another Joseph Cotten movie. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Like he was always a leading man. He had great parts and some reason he just doesn't get the memory and love of bigger stars.
That's true. Look at the 70s TV, cred this guy's got. Streets of San Francisco.
Maybe that's it. He made TV and then everybody's like, oh,
yeah, everyone blew it off because that was different then. Airport 77.
He was in Soylent Green, for goodness sake.
Soylent Green. He was in Fantasy Island. Like all the.
Well, he was in Fantasy Island. So there you go. That's what happened.
But he did all right.
He started doing TV. I bet that's what happened because, as we know, for a long time, and it's just now starting to end. If you were a movie actor, you didn't do TV unless your career was falling apart.
Mm.
And in the late 60s, he started doing TV.
I didn't know he was in Citizen Kane. He was in that, I guess. Screening room.
Yeah, he's the friend.
He's the screening room operator, it says. Or reporter, sorry. Is that the friend? Yeah. I don't know. Jedediah Leland, he played in that. I don't remember. I have a bad memory of that. Hey, look at this. His first movie in 1938 was called Too Much Johnson. Boy, you're telling me, buddy. You're telling me.
Yeah, in my opinion, there is not enough Johnson. Thank you very much.
Oh, I don't know. I think
he started. Actually, Cotten started doing TV in the 50s with the Ford Television Theater. Maybe just made a bad choice.
Yeah, or I mean, look, that's where all those guys went to die is Fantasy Island and Love Boat, right? Like that's the era. Those actors were.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is he started doing it as soon as TV was around. Oh. Like as soon as the General Electric Theater was on the air in 1954, he was on it.
Yeah,
so,
I could see
I
that.
Think maybe he made a bad bet.
Yeah.
It's like, TV's going to kill the movies. I'll just start doing it now.
Yeah, that's true. Chat says, is he the one with a speed addiction? Sidian, how do you even know that? How do you know any of these people would have a speed addiction? He's probably right because Sidian's always right. So I'm not going to question it.
Yeah, never doubt.
Yeah, never doubt Sidian, no matter what you do. All right. As far as
never start a land war in Asia and never doubt Sidian.
Those are the two things you should never do. All right. If I was to rate this in the caveat of or the cavalcade of films we've watched or the caveat the caveat of films
warning we watch these films
I think I'm gonna put it in my top three of the old stuff, like the really old stuff that I would put this in, like, you know, I liked it better than Citizen Kane. Is that bad?
Wow.
Yeah.
Third Man, better than Citizen Kane.
In
Scott Johnson.
My opinion, all right? You may say Too Much Johnson. I wouldn't blame you. But in my opinion, I feel like this was, I had more fun with this, or I was more entertained, let's say, and less confused. Because I felt I was confused by Citizen Kane. Just kind of threw me a little bit. This did not do that to me. But I would put it, I would also put this behind 12 Angry Men, which I would actually put in terms of black and white films we've seen, I'd put that at number one.
Yeah.
And I'm not counting Schindler's List because that's kind of a trick.
Casablanca is number one for all of us, no matter what you think you feel.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I like that one too. I've liked them all. I shouldn't try to rank
them. No. I mean, I'm just saying Casablanca will always be my favorite. I think that's the perfect movie.
And we can't rank. Ranking is a folly.
It's getting harder to rank, man. Like this is our 22nd movie.
Oh my gosh, dude, really?
Yeah.
That's 22 months. That's almost 2 years of this. Can that be true?
Yeah.
What? I feel like we just started it. That's crazy.
I was explaining this to Brian Brushwood on Cord Killers the other day, and I was like, so we made a list, kind of a collaborated list of the best movies of all time, and we watched them in reverse order, meaning each one is worse than the last.
Yeah.
not that any of these are bad, right? But it is funny to be like, okay, Third Man, number 22.
Yeah, we are working our way down, but that's okay because we don't have to mention it yet, but I'm very stoked about next month because it's a movie I should have seen and never did. And so,
well, that's kind of the point of this whole thing, right? Is yeah. for us to watch movies that we should have seen and never did.
And in some cases we have, but it's okay because it's great to revisit them, or we haven't seen them in too long, or we didn't appreciate them the first three times we saw them or whatever. But, you know, when we did Star Wars, that seems dumb on the surface because Tom and I watch Star Wars 500 times a year.
How many times, right?
But yeah. So what? Like, let's look at it through these eyes. Let's look at it through our...
There's something different about watching even a movie that I've seen before from the point of view of, A, this is on a list of the best movies of all time, and B, I'm watching it to talk about on Current Geek.
Right.
So The Third Man, for instance, I saw this in college as part of my film class. I got, you know, the zither stuck in my head from there for the rest of my life, following me around. But I hadn't seen it since. Mm. And... this is, want to get one last interesting fact in. Graham Greene was a novelist, wrote a book for the movie first.
What?
He wanted to write The Third Man for Carol Reed. So as an exercise, he wrote a book to be able to line out the story, because he knew how to line out stories well in the novel, and then adapted his novel to the screenplay himself.
But he still wrote it for
the... he wanted to make sure he could flesh out the characters by writing a novel.
He still wrote it for the film, though. Like, when he...
he wrote it, Carol Reed said, write The Third Man. He's like, great. What I'm going to do is write a book first and then turn that in the screenplay so that I know who these characters are when I write the screenplay. They didn't put the book out until much, much later.
Huh. So did people just assume it was a book based on the movie? Which is kind of true anyway.
Yeah, it kind of feels like once they put it out, people would be like, oh, it's a novelization. But they put it out so much later, I think people knew.
Wow, that's crazy. What an interesting thing. Like, that's just talks to his process, I guess. But, you know.
It was a way he wanted to do it.
They don't do that normally. Normally, it's like, hey,
oh no,
hey, yeah. J.K. Rowling, you want to make a movie for Harry Potter that's been already huge and popular for 12 years? Yeah, let's do it. And then they go and make it. That makes more sense to me. I was going to add something else to add to that, because that's crazy to me that you would write a whole book, make your movie, then release the book that you wrote for the movie in the first place. But technically, the movie's based on a book.
One of the reasons it's so good with the atmosphere is because he did that. He's like, he wanted to make sure his characters were deep. He had a good atmosphere. So he wrote the book. It's a novella. It's not a full length novel.
Right.
And he took a tour of Vienna in 1948, kind of showed him around, gave him the atmosphere. I'm trying to find when they actually released the book.
Was it filmed in Vienna?
Partially, yeah. Partially? Some of it was filmed in a stage in London, but a lot of it was filmed on the streets of Vienna.
Okay. Because it did have a kind of an authenticity that I didn't expect. There were a couple scenes where I was like, yeah, that's a matte painting or whatever, but a lot of the street stuff felt like they were maybe in a legit place, which added to the mystique of the film, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But that surprised me just because, I don't know.
They did 6 weeks of principal photography in Vienna and then made use of the Sievering Studios facilities there, as well as the Wharton Hall Studios in Isleworth and Shepperton Studios near London.
Do you think the craft services there was just Vienna sausages all day long? Do you think that's what happened?
I think they just call them sausages.
Okay. Also, when you're in Vienna, it's not Vienna sausages, it's just sausages. And also, I'm sure they're not those short little things.
By the way, the scenes in the sewer were partly shot on location, partly shot on a set at Shepperton. The location shots used a double for Wells.
Oh, interesting. He wasn't even there for that.
He was there for part of it, but they used doubles because he was reluctant to shoot in the sewers.
Oh, by the way, was he a neat freak or something? Is that his deal? He didn't want
to... I don't know. I don't think you have to be a neat freak to say, you know, I'd rather not shoot in a sewer.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. You don't have to be a complete clean... you don't have to be an OCD clean freak to not want to be in a sewer. I get that.
But assistant director Guy Hamilton in a 2015 interview said that Graham Greene and Carol Reed worked very well together, but Orson Welles, quote, generally annoyed everyone on.
Yeah, sounds right. Sounds
and,
like
that. And Guy Hamilton is the one who stepped in as the body double for Welles when he was absent.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, there is a scene in this toward the end of the sewer thing that I think is really good. And it's when Welles is reaching for that vent, you know, kind of in vain because he's about to die or he's too, yeah, you know, he's too shot.
His fingers like Vienna sausage.
And the way it does it, you hear the sounds of the street and the wind of the city and all that stuff when the fingers are out. Brilliant for something made in 49. It just felt so, that is a very powerful visual and yeah. combination with sound and stuff. It's awesome. Cannot say enough about that moment. That stuck out to me, and I was like, I got to bring that up on the show because that was really
There are
cool.
so many good visuals yeah. in this movie. Like that is its biggest appeal. And I think it's why, to my own discredit, I probably like this movie less than a lot of the other ones we've seen because I'm not as excited about great visuals. And I know I should be. I'm sorry. I'm a total Philistine. But I'm much more excited by dialogue. And the third man, I appreciate, don't get me wrong. I appreciate all of that. It's, and I guess what I would say is if you're into good visuals, if that's what makes a movie for you, third man is your jam.
Oh yeah.
It's gotta be.
Heck yeah. If you're looking for vintage stuff that looks amazing for its time. And even now this movie's got that all over the place, but it's not to say that you don't at least acknowledge when you go to see a Star Wars. You go see a Star Wars movie, you're not going, I'm only here for the dialogue. I mean, obviously you want to see cool
right,
effects.
I don't close my eyes
right.
and be like, nope, only dialogue. I just mean that like that scene that you're talking about when he's putting his fingers out, I'm watching that going, wow, this is a really good visual about a trapped man trying to escape and freedom being just out of his grasp. And I get all that, but it doesn't hit me in the feels. It doesn't get me like smiling and jumping up out of my seat the way other things might.
Yeah, I get that. Well, that's the movie. It is The Third Man. You should watch it. It's on Netflix. There's no reason not to. It's a decent transfer. I think the sound's a little weird, but it's probably just the movie and nothing else. So go check that out. Next month.
Next month, we'll be watching The Fourth Man.
The Fourth Man, who's also a taxi driver on the weekends.
Okay. So you're going to transition to the actual thing.
Taxi Driver, the 1976 Scorsese classic, will be on the chopping block next week.
Is this our first Scorsese?
Let me think for a minute.
I think
yes.
it might be.
Also, how is it his movies aren't higher on the list?
I know.
Because that's right? nutty.
All that Hitchcock stuff in his way.
Yeah, all the Hitchcock and the freaking, all his buddies he grew up with. Like, you gotta push the Godfathers out of the way. Goodfellas is amazing. Oh my gosh. There's so many good Scorsese movies, but we're going to go with, I think, kind of his first big deal was Taxi Driver, wasn't it? That was the big one.
Oh yeah. He's walking here.
Yeah. This was his Jaws. If you want to compare those
careers.
I think
so. And in a way I'd say it's better.
Yeah.
And it's higher on the list than Jaws. So there you go.
And I would put it higher on the list. I think I'd put Scorsese higher on the list. I should say that the guy knows how to make films that you'll never forget. And sometimes I hate them. Like I hated Wolf of Wall Street. Hated it. But there was no doubt in my mind it was being made
you
by.
You almost said Wharf of Wall Street. Yeah, and now I absolutely want to see that
Wharf
movie.
Wharf of Wall Street.
These investment returns are not making me a merry man.
There is no honor in buying high and selling low. Yeah, I'd watch that. That'd be a thing.
Greed is good.
Yeah.
Wait, no, that's a different
thing. No, that's a different, whole different thing. But anyway, we get to see Taxi Driver, and I'm excited. 1976's Taxi Driver, that's next month on Current Geek, the Film Festival edition.
We are entering an interesting period in our Current Geek Film Fest where the obvious big movies are at the top. And so now our little algorithm of combining Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb, and the American Film Institute is starting to yield more diverse selections.
Oh, yeah.
We've got an animated film coming up. We've got a sci-fi superhero film coming up. We have a Japanese, our first Kurosawa coming up. It's going to get more and more interesting, I think.
I have never seen a Kurosawa film, so that's exciting. Because I fully am aware of his influence, but I've never partaken directly. And I would like to. So
I like what you did on Twitch, watching it with the audience too.
That was really fun. I wasn't sure. I mean, like I said, the reason I did it to start with was, oh, this is out of print, or it's, you know, no copyright. I'll just do it. And then as I started, I went, oh no, wait, I can't show this. So then just watching it was fun, and people seemed to enjoy it. So maybe we'll do that again. But I'm jazzed about what's coming up. This is one of my favorite things we do, is this little thing. This offshoot of Current Geek. So if you guys enjoy it as well, head on over to our Patreon and show us your love. Patreon.com/currentgeek is the place to do it. We would love it. That'd be wonderful. Don't forget, Legal Geek is on right after this with a review of the Supreme Court decision from this week that declined to stop partisan gerrymandering and what that means for gerrymandering and election fairness in the future. If you don't know what any of that means, he breaks it down in a very academic, fascinating way without all the partisan yelling that you're used to. So if you want to understand more, check out Legal Geek right after we're done talking here. Tom Merritt, anything else in your neck of the woods before we go?
Why, yes, Scott. I'm keeping people up to date on all the podcasts I do and the writing I do. If you want early peeks at the stuff that I write, get some interesting stories, even some short stories, I've got a writing Patreon, and you can keep up to date with that and all the podcasts I do at freetomnewsletter.com. Just go subscribe. You can even look at the old version, so you don't even have to subscribe if you just want to go visit it. freetomnewsletter.com.
Nice. You guys should go do all that and more. Also check out frogpants.com if you like this content. You're looking for more. Plenty of shows to get your heads around over there at frogpants.com. And I think it's going to do it for us. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget to check us out on the web. currentgeek.com is the website. And we'll be back here next time with a whole new episode. It'll be news next week. Until then, take care.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review one of the final big decisions of the Supreme Court term, that being the partisan gerrymandering case. We covered the gerrymandering cases last year in detail when they first went up to the Supreme Court, but here's a quick refresher. Gerrymandering is the practice of drawing electoral district lines in such a way to give an unfair advantage to a certain political party, or a race, or some other group. Electoral districts are typically drawn every 10 years after a census, leading to this conflict coming up over time. The Supreme Court and other courts have stepped in historically to throw out partisan gerrymanders that are race-based, but the bigger question remained of whether politically motivated gerrymanders could be addressed by the court. In 2004, the Supreme Court most recently spoke on the issue, declining to consider the issue as a purely legislative or political matter. At that time, the fifth justice in the majority was Justice Kennedy, who indicated in a concurring opinion that he was open to judges evaluating such gerrymanders, but only if an adequate test could be formed. That led to development of various tests in the last 15 years, including the efficiency gap test, where the popular vote in a state is compared to the percentage of legislative seats a party wins. These tests were developed to try and give the courts something to use to evaluate and throw out the most egregious of partisan gerrymanders. Last term, a case about a Wisconsin partisan gerrymander was kicked back to the lower courts on procedural issues. This year, a new case came back up to review a Democrat-favoring gerrymander in Maryland and Republican-leaning gerrymander in North Carolina. In the case of one of the gerrymanders, the party in charge of drawing the district lines did not hide at all that the district lines were being drawn to favor their own political party, which is the boldest type of partisan gerrymander one can imagine. Nevertheless, Justice Kennedy is no longer at the Supreme Court. So it should come as no surprise that the conservative justices led a 5-4 decision, consistent with the 2004 decision, declining to adjudicate partisan gerrymandering issues because they are purely legislative issues outside the scope of what the courts can review, by their view. The dissent, written by Justice Kagan, harshly described this decision as the first time ever the court refused to remedy a constitutional violation because it thinks the task beyond judicial capabilities. But regardless of the passion in the dissent, partisan gerrymandering stands and will not be stopped by the federal courts. So what happens from here? We are coming up on another census in 2020, and the state legislators elected next year will then have a chance to redraw political districts, perhaps with some states becoming more bold in their unfair partisan gerrymandered maps. However, while the federal courts have now declined to apply the U.S. Constitution to partisan gerrymanders, state courts could still apply their own state constitutions to block certain egregious gerrymanders in the future. Furthermore, many states like Michigan and Ohio have recently put into place laws or constitutional amendments requiring bipartisan line-drawing commissions or reviews of electoral districts, in an effort to make sure the line-drawing is done fairly. Expect more such state laws and constitutional amendments moving forward, as the battle over partisan gerrymandering goes into the states. The bottom line is, when it comes to gerrymandering, it is clear that the federal courts will be no recourse unless the gerrymander is on the basis of race or a protected class, not just politics. That makes the 2020 vote a hugely important one, since the census will cause district redrawing with whoever gets elected next cycle. While this decision may be a blow for election fairness in certain states, the impetus is now on the states to elect legislatures that will draw reasonable and fair districts, or put in independent commissions or the like to ensure the fairness. Gerrymandering is here to stay, but the battles will continue in the states over this contentious issue. Hey, will you be at Gen Con in Indianapolis next month? If so, The Legal Geek will be there presenting on IP law and game design on Thursday and Friday. Please come check out these educational seminars or track me down on Twitter for a meetup. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.